name is Margie, and I serve the village as a barista, and also for this last week, I help out with teaching staff. And we've had two amazing sessions today, and we have a third amazing session tonight. Maureen, who says we can all call her Mo, which I'm definitely going to do. Mo is going to be talking to us about women's health and how to be an advocate for that, among many other things. Mo encourages discussion, so if you feel comfortable moving to the front row or the second row or kind of rounding out this circle, I think it's going to be very discussion-based from what I hear. Just so all of you know, the session is being recorded and will be up in the archive section of our website, so keep that in mind. The last thing you should know about Mo is she's a music major, which means she and Matthew will definitely perform something right? Correct. So without further ado, welcome Mo!
Thank you very much, all of you guys, for letting me come here and talk with you all today. I'm really pleased to come here and share a little bit myself, and then hopefully to also learn about all of you by the end of the talk. As you probably already know, my name is Maureen Mo, and this is my first time at Holden Village. I have heard about Holden Village for years, ever since meeting my husband Matthew, who has been coming for the last 10 years, minus last year during the Wolverine fire. He has been working in the Holden kitchen and in the woodworking shop, and especially recently becoming performing as a village musician. And he's spoken so highly of it that I could think of no better birthday present to him than to come here and be here with him, experience the village, and of course get a little good teaching session in there. So happy birthday, Matthew, and
yes.
Happy birthday.
When's your birthday?
Today, I didn't come specifically prepared to talk about politically charged issues related to women's health, although if that's where people want to go, I'm more than happy to facilitate discussion about it, because there's certainly lots and lots and lots of things that we could talk about. And I do think it's a really valuable conversation to have, and if that's the way that people want to take the conversation tonight, by all means, let's do that. The way that I sort of framed this discussion, and surprise, I'm not really going to talk about women's health either, because what I'm going to sort of talk about actually is things that have, in the past kind of year for me, come to the forefront as kind of important building blocks of leadership and ways to make an impact in the world around you. And I think it relates to women's health because I'll get a little bit into my background, but I'm an obstetrician gynecologist by training, and I just finished my residency. And so kind of everything that I do, I feel is in the framework of women's health and how do we improve health of those around us, women and men, but specifically for me. That's kind of the line of work that I'm in. So today I'm going to specifically talk about my journey becoming a physician, a leader, and an advocate for the issues that I really believe in. And at the end, I have time just kind of set out for a discussion. And feel free to ask questions throughout or share your own experiences, since I am by no means an expert in all the things that I'll be speaking about today, just definitely an interested learner. So this is kind of what I'm going to talk about, some of my early influences, leadership, different things kind of related to, and I think leadership, when I say it, kind of relates to, even in everyone's own life, how do you expose yourself to people around you, how do you act as a roving leader, advocacy, and then a discussion at the end. And I did go to the, anybody who was at the safety briefing this morning? Yeah? Okay, only one person. Well, okay, a couple more people. So you all know that this could be how my talk goes, or this might be how the talk goes. what you guys want to do. I just had one thing, discussions. So just a little bit about me. I grew up in small town Minnesota. I went to college at University of Wisconsin-Madison. like Margie said, I majored in voice performance, and then like most 22-year-olds, you finish college and you're like, now what do I do? I found myself in a lucky position to get to do some volunteering at a little parish in Chimbote, Peru, which is, it was just on the rural kind of coastline of Peru, and having not really any idea of what I wanted to do, I found a faith-based community that had a lot of good works going on. They were doing things in their community to build up the impoverished community, and luckily I just got to go there, and they needed somebody in women's health, so I got to volunteer doing women's exams and preventative visits and help out a little bit in labor and delivery, and even help deliver a couple of some babies, which was really fun because who doesn't love delivering babies? I then went on, I did a master's in public health and epidemiology, and I think that public health kind of is just the study of how do we keep our world around us healthy, and I think a lot of people have ideas in how we like to do that, and I just went on to get a little more formal training in it, and then after that I went to medical school residency in OBGYN at the University of Minnesota, and I just finished in June. So I keep telling Matthew, we've only known each other since I have been in residency, and I'm like, you don't even know how much fun I can do, and I'm not a resident. So it's a thing to live through. So this is really kind of I feel like Holden is probably a place that people come at a crux of life when you're kind of between big things that are going on for you, and that's definitely where I find myself today, and it's really fun to be here and share this time with all of you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about leadership and why did I get interested in leadership. And one thing I know I put on the bio was that I was lucky enough to go to the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland, and get some time to be able to watch world leaders doing public health, doing women's health, talking about how do we help our legislators and our lawmakers be informed about keeping women healthy. I got to spend a little bit of time with the Minnesota Department of Health. So this is Ed Ellinger, who's the Commissioner of Health for Minnesota, and Amy Klobuchar, one of our senators from Minnesota. I got to spend some time at University of Minnesota. ICSI, these would make more sense if you're from Minnesota, but Health Partners, Alliant Health, and some other places. And then finally, I also did kind of a leadership academy for residents, and this was just kind of sort of like a thoughtful practice of how do we go out and be stewards of information and lead people into healthier lives. So the first thing that I kind of wanted to talk about is, and this is going to seem like really crazy, but it's just something that's super fun to talk about, and it's I like to call it know thyself. So what is your personality type? And this maybe seems like it's coming out of left field, but Matthew knows me, he knows that this is just kind of like, it runs in my blood. So when you're thinking about kind of leading a group of people, personality type, everybody's going to be put into a role of leadership at some point in their life, and often many points, especially when a work setting, in a camp setting, whether or not we want to be, everybody here is a leader in different ways. People will listen to what you say, and your move will often dictate the tone of the environment. What is it that makes someone a successful leader or an unsuccessful leader? I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that I learned in this leadership course that I went through. So, personality type, Myers-Briggs personality type. Anybody heard of this before? Okay, you all know your types already?
Yeah, okay.
So I should figure I'm speaking to, preaching to the choir, as they say. I'm going to give a little bit of background on the Myers-Briggs personality type, and I love this as a sort of a self-indicator, just to help you remind you who you are and kind of keep things in perspective. So in terms of Myers-Briggs personality type, Carl Jung first proposed the theory of psychological types in the early 1900s, and then Catherine Briggs and Isabel Myers were a mother and daughter duo who actually in the 1940s around World War II developed it into an actual personality tool when women were entering the workforce during World War II to help them be better matched with jobs. And so the way that they organized Jung's information was into these four different continuums. So E versus I, S versus N, T versus F, and J versus P. And they Jung essentially believed that each of these are innate to our personality and can be influenced by environmental influences like family, country, education, and we all use both sides of each continuum. So it's not that one person is 100% a thinker and not a feeler at all. It's just more of like a natural preference. So if you think like right-handed, left-handed type things, you can imagine that if you're a right-handed person, you could cut an onion with your left hand, it would just be a little bit more difficult and you would probably prefer to do it with the other hand, but you could teach yourself to do it the other way. That's sort of the same principle of a Myers-Briggs. We all have preferences, but we can change how we use our preferences and how we develop ourselves. The other thing to know about this test that maybe I'm just, again, preaching to the choir, but this test starts for preference, but not for ability or aptitude. So just because somebody is a T, a thinker, doesn't mean that they're actually a better thinker than somebody who's an F. And similarly, those who are Fs don't necessarily have any better emotional reactions than the T counterparts. Does anybody want to share what they are right now? Or you can think about it. Oh, yeah?
I'm an ENF, and I was a J, and then I grew into a P. And I think this probably helped me.
Yeah.
I think it's a common camp type personality.
Yep, ENFP, totally.
And ditto.
Yep.
I'm an INFJ.
Okay. Also an INFJ. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I like what Wendy said about the fact that you can kind of be one thing and then it can kind of morph to something else. Because definitely a lot of these can be situational and even just kind of focused on time period in life. So if you're in college, you can be pretty willy-nilly schedule-wise, and maybe you're more of a P, and then maybe you have a brand new baby, and every 2 hours that baby needs to eat, so you're really keeping track of it, and you have a good checklist going, or something like that. So those are examples of how you might. I'll just share with you, mine is ESFJ, and we'll go through all of them kind of briefly, and then you can kind of see how you get assigned to one or another of each of these things. And if you don't know your type, you can do a paid version on the MBTI.com, or you can do a free version, which is pretty quick and easy, on 16personalities.com, which is just kind of like a new little website that I found. But so, again, if this is not discussion-based enough and people want to just talk about it, let me know. And also, if everybody knows this already, then no problem. But so E's are people that focus on the outside world, other people, events, actions, and things. They're really energized by being around people, and they focus their energy outward, where I's focus on the internal world, thoughts, emotions, and experiences. E's tend to gain energy by acting. So a lot of times you'll see this would be the person that kind of acts, then reflects, then acts again. I's, on the other hand, they might be the people that they are thinking, then acting, and then thinking again. An E might be someone who, if left too long to kind of think by themselves, they actually kind of start losing energy. And I's might be the opposite. If they're around people for too long, they actually just start getting totally drained of energy and just need to go alone and be by themselves. Most people are a healthy mix of both and favor one or another at certain points in life. The next is sensing versus intuition. Sensing focuses on the present, current facts and events, and N focuses on the future, new opportunities and ideas. So S's tend to trust what they see, hear, and sense. Literally, the things they can sense, like sight, sound, feel, smell, and taste. S's are good at noticing details, they tend to do what's practical, and they're very specific and literal when speaking, writing, and listening. They deal with the here and now, and not so much in the future. Sort of like, so the opposite is N's. N's tend to listen to the subconscious. They're good at seeing the perspective, prefer to do what's innovative. They tend to go beyond what's real or concrete and then focus on the meanings, associations, and relationships. The thing that I think is helpful to know whether you're an S or an N, especially kind of in a work setting or when you're kind of trying to do things in a team, is the S tends to be, and this is me so I can say this, kind of tends to be the naysayer or can be the naysayer of things, because they'll say, no, we've done this, the reason we don't do it is like that is because we've tried it like that before and it doesn't work. Whereas N's might be the people that say, oh, we can try anything, it'll be great, like, I'll just come up with a new way to do it and it's no problem. So I think it's really useful if you're in a group of people to know kind of what your tendency is, because if I know that I'm an S and I can't think of any new way to do something, knowing that I can tap into people that are identified more as Ns, then they can hopefully dial me into something that might be a new and innovative idea.
It seems like that runs the risk though of just like putting yourself into a rut and like, this is the way I work. Mm-hmm. And like, it just like oversimplifies it, and then that becomes I am an N, and then that seems really dangerous, at least to me.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think that when we were making this conceptualization, and you could sort of see on this slide here, is that what it says is that I'm not totally one thing or another thing. It's, you're falling somewhere along this continuum of, I know what my preference is. I know that my preference is to be more shut down about new ideas. And so what I'm trying to do is work with my left hand and say, okay, but I know that there's part of me that is good at being innovative or is good at thinking of new ideas and letting that flow. And so this is basically a construct that to understand what your own preference might be. So it's not saying that I'm 100% this and you're 100% that, but I think sometimes it's a helpful construct to think about, why do I, when this person and I are talking, they always seem like they're just getting really excited about these ideas that I'm pretty sure won't work. But sometimes they work. And so sometimes it's, I think of it as a way of helping yourself work with other people in a collaborative way and also develop those parts of yourself that will allow new things to happen for you. So I think it's hard to know where you can go to until you kind of know what's my natural preference and where can I grow, into it. And so sometimes it's just role modeling of, oh, that person, they're always coming up with these new ideas and I don't think about that, but maybe. So it's not meant to be prescriptive. Mm-hmm. And it's also, they make a pretty big deal of when you take the test of saying, even if you come out as whatever, whatever letters, if you disagree with that, that's a great starting point. Because then you can say, oh, maybe I am actually really evenly split between these two. Or maybe there's some days where I'm really an E and other days where I'm really an I. And it's not meant to say one is better than another. It's just meant to say, oh, well, it's a way to think about it, to maybe understand. For me, the most that it has helped understand where are the people coming from in different kinds of situations. The third continuum is sensing versus intuition. Oh, wait. We talked about this one. So, sorry, the third one is thinking versus feeling. And this is just kind of the way that people process information. So people that process more as T's tend to make conclusions based on logical analysis. And to someone who's an F, that might look very stern and cold. They might convince other people through factual and impersonal argument and make decisions based on objective logic. They might make a pros and cons list. They focus on problems and tasks, but not on relationships. And they might overlook personal impacts of their decisions. F, on the other hand, they might feel things with their heart. They appreciate peace. They need harmony in relationships. They might convince other people through personal influence. They are good at understanding other people and their viewpoints and concentrate on relationships and harmony. The example that I can think of this, how it could be like a, it could come up in your workplace or in your relationships, is that people who are Fs, they might just be more flustered by if they're having an interpersonal conflict with someone. And so maybe I was trying to get all this work done, but then I just felt like I got in a disagreement with Sally or something happened, and now I just can't continue my work until that's resolved. That might be more of an F personality trait, whereas a T might say more, they just kind of expect that there's a certain amount they might not even recognize that it's a conflict at all, they might just expect that a little bit of conflict just exists all the time, and that's normal, and it's not a bother, and so they can continue kind of going along through their daily life or daily work. And I think this is an important one. If you know that someone, if you know that you're more toward a T side and maybe you're in charge of a group of workers and you're kind of aware that maybe they're more on F side and maybe one day you notice they don't really seem to be getting very much work done today, I don't know why not. Sometimes that can just be as simple as, oh, there's something off with the mojo of the group that day, and as a T, you're not picking up on it because it wouldn't be bothersome to you, and you'd still be able to get your work done. So knowing those things kind of just can help you kind of hone in on, well, what's going on, and you just have to ask somebody to key yourself in. The example that I sort of love to tell about FNT is, if you separated, my dad went to a workshop where they actually did this. They separated people into two groups, the Fs and the Ts, and they said, okay, here's a conundrum. You have 12 people on a little league team, and you guys made it to state, but you can only bring 9. How are you going to decide who to bring? And what do you think the Fs said?
That we're not going.
Well, how well do they, who gets along with each other? Who plays well as a team player? The relationship question.
Our attendance policy, we should choose people like him and everything, or maybe those that have like, really good attitudes, or maybe a little bit of like ability. We should like think about that too. Like those all seem like really important things that we should consider when we only get to send 9 people. And the T's, what do you think they say?
Scale.
Ability. Let's just send the 9 best people, right? And it's just that, and so you can see how if you were on the Little League team and maybe you were an F and then you didn't get chosen, you would just be like, oh, but if your coaches are both T's, they're not picking up on that. It's not even a thing. So, just an example of how we go throughout our daily lives and maybe don't even think about some of these like ways that we're just processing information all the time that are other people's kind of filters or ways of thinking about things. And then finally, J's. So J's perform better with a plan, and they live life. These are kind of your checklist, checky box people that are really comfortable saying, yes, I can commit to hanging out with you on October 17th, 2017. No issues with that. They see life as a series of decisions to be made, and they kind of want to just check the boxes. They like to get things settled and finished. They like environments with structure and clear limits, and they work pretty well with deadlines because they can plan things out to get there at a certain time. And P's are a little more concerned with the experience getting there along the way, and making decisions feels a little bit more like getting boxed in, and committing to something feels a little bit uncomfortable, and it seems like there's going to be a lot more time to finish things before we get to the end, and so maybe I'm not really comfortable saying that I'm going to do that, and especially not in 2017. That would kind of make me freak out if I were a P. They sometimes need to rush to complete things at the last minute because they're not always able to plan ahead as well, and sometimes they will get kind of angry about making decisions because that's not really their natural proclivity. And you can think of, I'm sure you've all gone on a trip with someone who is a little bit different than you in this way, and the day that you buy the ticket, the person that you're traveling with has shared a Google Doc with you and listed out every single day, and they're like buying every single ticket, and
the trip from
maybe you guys are all P's because you're both verbal. And then on the other hand, you have people who are like, 6-month backpacking trip, I'll just put my shoes and a couple t-shirts in this bag. Yeah, man, here we go. Which you can see how that'd be uncomfortable to somebody else who is like more of a checklist planner. So obviously these are kind of processing, and I think J's and P's are really easy to kind of see, and also this is one that we tend to change a little bit throughout life. So if you do have a schedule that's lets you be a little bit more open-ended, then you don't have to be quite so checklist oriented. Then as you can see, it kind of organizes into 16 different personality types based on where you fall on each of the continuum. And then there's a lot of really cool websites about, you can read about, you know, the ESTJ as a parent or the ESTJ as a coworker or, you know, in a personal and professional relationships or career choices for you and other things like that. And I think it can just be kind of illuminating actually to read about. So I'm sort of into that, obviously, as you can tell, because I spent half the time already just talking about that. I did a little bit of Guess That Type, and I know you guys are kind of big fans of Harry Potter around here, so I'll give you a couple. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes?
Definitely a J.
And a T.
G-S-T-J.
I know I-S-T-J, I'd say.
You guys are so good. things about the ISTJ. George Washington, also ISTJ. Practically masculine, reliability cannot be doubted. They're dutiful, they're no nonsense. Honesty is important. Some people might have the impression that they're cold or even robotic. ISTJs are kind of the, I don't think I wrote down actually what the name of the personality is on here.
Can I ask if anyone in the room is an ISTJ?
My husband is.
Oh, you're an ENFP? And he's an ISTJ?
Whoa.
I learned to go over the J a lot to keep them comfortable.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes, and you're talking about, when you said you kind of lean towards what he is to make him more comfortable, I find that Kent and I are both J's, but I become more of a P. By contrast, so I think the balance kind of goes both ways.
So Phil Dunphy.
Does everybody know who Phil Dunphy
is? Yeah. Modern Family.
He's a character in Modern Family.
Definitely an E.
Yep, he's an E.
An N. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, N.
F.
Yeah, F, N, probably.
A P.
P, yeah, E and F, P.
Yeah.
Oh, there's Phil.
So also, what it said about that is also Michael Scott from The Office. So these are the people that know how to relax, switch from passionate, driven idealist to a free spirit on the dance floor, energy. We believe everyone should take some time to recognize and express their feelings. Kate Middleton, I don't know, because we all know her personality. Anne Hathaway is the same.
She's an I.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how validated this is.
ISTP.
So this thing thinks that she could be an ISFJ.
Okay.
Take responsibility.
Oh, is she Becky?
Going above and beyond. Excellent memories. May never be truly comfortable in the spotlight.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones.
Oh.
I.
Mm-hmm. He's an S.
How do you know T?
Because it has to be by himself.
J.
Yeah.
Yeah.
STJ. Yeah.
So
he
is ISTP.
Oh,
yeah. Just maybe. Good.
You sure he's just not tapping into his intuition every time he has something come up?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. Maybe. I have a couple more of these. So Michael Jackson.
Hi.
Flexible and charming, ready to explore and experience something new. Kevin Costner is also the same as Michael Jackson. This one is the hardest to unfold, I think.
Hmm.
He's kind of an enigma. I feel like Kevin Costner also is kind of an enigma.
I
don't know him well. This says that he's ISFP, so they're like the artists. Sensitive, loose feelings, challenged to step away from the moment long enough not to get caught up in the heat of the moment, live in a colorful, sensual world. Marilyn Monroe. Also, Leo and Miley Cyrus. Their type is the entertainer. So they are the ESFP. Social.
What do you think Peter is?
This might be the last one. Yeah. Also Judge Judy. ESTJ. Value honesty, dedication, dignity. People with the ESTJ are valued for clear advice and guidance, and happily they go into the world pass. So again, if you are interested in this at all, 16personalities.com. This is really easy, cheap, free one.
Free one.
Okay. So I'm gonna. Knowing yourself, knowing kind of your personality and what makes you tick and how you work in groups of people, I think is really important in being a leader. The second thing that I wanted to kind of share with you guys is this idea of emotional intelligence. And it basically comes from this idea. There was a psychologist named Daniel Goldman who studied, he works at Harvard and Rutgers University, and he studied 200 different, like, Fortune 500 companies to look at their CEOs to see what do these people have in common that makes them really successful leaders that's not, maybe hadn't been identified, but the idea that these people, you know, you can be really technically savvy, you can be super smart and have great ideas, but that doesn't really make you a leader. And so how do you get in front of a group of people? How do you gain a vision? How do you lead a group of people? And he came up with five components of what he calls emotional intelligence. So as you can see here, these are all these five qualities that I've written up on the PowerPoint are not things that you would necessarily think of as something that would be found in someone in a business environment. And they don't really seem super business-like. Empathy, self-awareness, motivation, maybe motivation, but social skills, self-regulation. But what he was able to do is actually take these five qualities and show that they can make companies fuse better together, work better together, and actually have better results. And I challenge you to think of this not like business, like we're gonna earn more money and, you know, make more widgets here at Boulder Village, but how do you make a group of people come together and be a leading force in that? And so I'm gonna talk about these five aspects just for a moment here. So self-awareness is the ability, he describes, the ability to recognize and understand your moods, emotions, and drives, as well as their effect on others. So somebody with a high self-awareness knows where they're headed and why. They might be the kind of person that turns down a higher paying job because they see that their values merge more with a job that's maybe lower paying, but gives them a finer idea of what their purpose is. And sometimes people that take the wrong kind of a job, that's inconsistent with goals and values, a couple of years in, they might find it really boring, or they might be conflict-ridden by being in that position. And so somebody with a high self-awareness would be more likely to say, you know, I'm going to turn down this opportunity because I just think it's not me. I'm going to go for the thing that's actually much more grounded in what my values and goals are. These are the kind of people that can do a realistic self-assessment. So this might be the kind of person that you're working with that is really easy. They might be the first person to admit when they've had a failure, but they can say it in a way that is very... sometimes they can be self-deprecating, but in a way that's honest and can admit to mistakes and respond well to constructive criticism. People that have low self-awareness might interpret feedback as a threat or a sign of failure, and people that are self-aware set themselves up for success and might be more able to actually learn from constructive feedback. So that's the idea of self-awareness. Then second is self-regulation. So this is basically the concept that we are all kind of prisoners of our own emotions unless we can, you know, take a deep breath and not act on every single thing that we feel. And basically what this looks like to the external person is that we are a reasonable human being. We can create an environment of trust and fairness. And in a work environment, what this creates is a feeling of trust and fairness. And I think the other thing that you would see with people that have a measure of self-regulation is that change is inevitable. It's going to come to all of us constantly, whether we're prepared for it or not. And people that have a better ability of self-regulation are actually able to temper some of those first kind of insecurities that you get as soon as you hear, oh, we're changing things again, or there's new rules about this or that. People that have a good self-regulation can say, okay, we're going to figure this out. I'm not going to say anything until I kind of have a little bit more information. and they can suspend judgment for the time being until faced with what they actually need to do, and then actually most oftentimes are able to roll with the roll of the changes a little bit easier than someone who doesn't have self-regulation. And then motivation. I like this one too, because especially, you know, being in the medical world, you can understand anyone could be motivated by having an impressive title or a big salary, but if you really want to change the lives of people around you for the better, then you will be able to achieve a goal. And this is kind of, motivation is sort of that. People that take pride in a job well done, they love to learn, people seek out a challenge. When you have a setback, you don't think of it necessarily as a sign that you're in the wrong area, but just a way to learn to improve. And it's sort of like an intrinsic wanting to do better. Empathy. And I think everyone kind of can relate to this feeling. You know, we've all been struck by the lack of empathy of a person who really just missed the mark in a comment they made, whether it was a boss or a teacher. And then conversely, somebody who, you know, really just sees you for where you are and what you need right at that point in time, and how much of a better human that you can be in the presence of someone who is very empathic. And of course, the word empathy seems not like it would necessarily be a hallmark of a successful business person or someone who successfully is, you know, leading a group of people or running an organization, but essentially it means being able to weigh a lot of different factors, including people's feelings and including the internal motivation of people, to be able to make intelligent decisions. And then social skills. So the first three components of emotional intelligence are all basically self-management skills, and the last two, empathy and social skill, kind of concern a person's ability to manage relationships with other people. And social skill, in the sense of being able to lead an organization, is not just friendliness, but rather friendliness with a purpose of being able to move people from point A to point B while understanding their motivations and then bringing them along with you. So emotional intelligence, I know it's kind of like a boring, dry topic just to talk about in front of a group of people, but I think it's truly one of those hallmarks that if you see somebody who has emotional intelligence, it will just strike a chord. And if anybody has any interest, there's a pretty great, like, 5-page article that Daniel Goleman wrote on this topic that kind of outlines a lot of these things. And I just think for anybody who's thinking of motivating your people or trying to be in a leadership position, it's just invaluable. I have another part about theories about leadership, which I'm going to skip right now because I don't want to get too far behind, and then we can come back to later if we want. So finally, advocacy. So I wanted to talk a little bit about advocacy because that was the talk. But I think the concept of advocacy is kind of taking leadership or you know, living your own life as a good citizen to the next level and saying, how can I affect other people? How can I understand the world, understand the impact that I have on the world, and then take responsibility for the world that we all live in? So I thought of the example today when we were talking in the safety training, we were talking about, and so if you see that someone is, you know, using a ladder the wrong way, then you really should stop them and say, hey, you're not using the ladder the right way. Why don't you use that in a more safe manner? Because we're all in it together, and we're all here to be accountable to each other. And I think advocacy, kind of citizenship, is sort of the same thing. You're talking about people who are making laws about abortion access or gun control or all of these things that I think, you know, as a society, we need to hold ourselves accountable for and examine, you know, what is the safest choice for us and how are we as people, you know, voters or other ways that we can advocate for making a safer and better public health in our world. I just went through a little bit of middle school civics review because I think sometimes a lot of this stuff, like, I haven't thought about it. I mean, I don't even know how well I absorbed it the first time that I heard it, but a little bit of like an overview, because I think especially in the election season, a lot of these things kind of come up, and if you listen to NPR, you get these words come thrown around a long time, a lot, and sometimes you just kind of forget what everything is. So, the Congress. The Congress is the House of Representatives and the Senate. In the House, there are 435 members. Each of them is elected to two-year terms, and this is population-based. So that's where you can see gerrymandering of lines to say, okay, well, we can get more of like a conservative group over here. If we just draw the lines a little bit differently. One example, in where we live in Minneapolis, there is like a horseshoe shape of a district that goes right outside Minneapolis because the first ring suburbs are pretty conservative, and they can just concentrate that, and that's how Michelle Bachmann got elected. So that's the House. They have an election every even number of years. In the Senate, we have 100 members. Each is elected to six-year terms, and of course, senators, then they represent there are two from each state, and so they represent the entire state, each of them. And a third of the Senate is up for re-election every election year. Every odd year, Congress convenes a new organization for a two-year period, and then it's divided into the first and second sessions. And right now we're on the 114th Congress. Every new Congress is a new slate, and bills must be reintroduced. So essentially, if they expire and they've never been talked about at the end of that session, then things get essentially lost or dead. So at the beginning of a new Congress, they have an election of leaders. So that's the Speaker of the House, the Senate Majority Leader, and then the committees. And so the Speaker of the House, so obviously we have sort of seen that there has been turnover, not just at the beginning of the new Congress, when John Boehner essentially sang zippity-doo-dah and got out of there and got Mulroney to take over for him. And then there's a Senate Majority Leader. And right now, I think we have actually a bicameral Republican, House and Senate. And then the committees are headed by these positions are elected at the same time when you start a new Congress. And then the majority party, which right now is Republican, dictates the agenda. So they will decide which bills get a hearing and get a vote. In the legislative process, any member, a senator or representative, can introduce a bill, and then there's so-called sponsor. The sponsor, who a lot of times obviously they've been approached by other people to kind of put a bill together, once they put a bill up on the floor, they recruit other members to co-sponsor their bill, which is important to know because if you end up doing any legislative advocacy or actually lobbying or talking to your elected officials, asking them to get behind a bill or sponsor a bill kind of shows that maybe what you want to do is ask them to co-sponsor a bill, which means they put their name on the bill, if they haven't already authored the bill. House bills start with HR and Senate bills start with an S. Committees, and then the chairs often choose the course of action. So they can do a number of different things, from holding a hearing, where they debate merits and discuss the actions of a bill. They can mark it up, amend, change, send to the floor for a vote, or they can take no action, and then that's a dead bill, and then essentially if that's not brought up in that session, then there would be no other debate on that bill. And then the House Speaker and Senate Majority Leader determine what legislation will go to the floor. And the floor debate, this is sort of interesting. So in the House, and this is the one with more members, 435 members, bills tend to pass. Bills pass a simple majority, and they have a lot of House rules that limit amendments and time to debate. But you can understand you would need if you have 435 people in that environment. In the Senate, there's very few rules, and any senator can amend and use procedural tactics such as the filibuster, which is, I'm sure everyone is familiar with, but a tactic to defeat by prolonging debate indefinitely, which is essentially where you just get up and you can read a cookbook and just keep talking to drop a discussion. The longest in our history was Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. In 1957, he spoke for 24 hours and 18 minutes unsuccessfully against the Civil Rights Act. And then a more recent example, as you guys might recall, Senator Wendy Davis, she's from Fort Worth, Texas, and she had an 11-hour long filibuster back in June 2013. Does anybody remember this?
Mm-hmm.
It was to block the Texas Senate Bill 5, which was a measure which included more restrictive abortion regulations for Texas. And she was successful in delaying the passage of the bill before midnight, which was the cutoff of that current session, although ultimately it passed in the second session of that year. And so now there's a lot of HARP laws and everything, yes, in Texas.
Finish your sentence. So I don't understand and this was maybe not the right forum, but like the purpose of a filibuster, is it to prolong something so that information can get gathered, or you can get more co-sponsors, or you can get more people on board? Or I've never understood the purpose of the objective of a filibuster.
I would open this up to the crowd. I mean, I'm not sure why we have rules that say that exists. I mean, I can understand how some people use it, but as in many things, I'm not sure if it was just a loophole at one point that people have exploited over time, but obviously it affects the way that our legislation happens. So I don't know, does anyone know the history?
People start voting differently because they want the person to stop.
Well, if you prolong the session enough and it ends, then people can go back to their offices and kind of start bargaining again. So there's a chance that you could sway the vote by making the session go over.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like if you
get
a good answer. Sounds good.
Right. You have to resubmit the bill if it's not passed by the end of the 2-year session or whatever, like in the Senate. So if you filibuster up to the beginning of the next session,
then you
have to go through everything, like getting the sponsors and the co-sponsors.
Thanks.
When you're outside the village again and you can stream, go to YouTube and look up Schoolhouse Rock.
Oh,
shit. Remember this? There's a really good, I wish I could remember the whole song, but it goes through all of this with music and a catchy tune, and I'm pretty sure they cover the filibuster.
There we go. I'm going to.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
But this is essentially how a bill gets passed. So the House and Senate, they pass different versions of the same bill, and then they have a conference to reconcile it into a common text. So a lot of times you hear things have gone to conference committee, and people on conference committee are someone that's appointed by the House and the Senate leaders. And if the agreement is made in conference, then the bill returns to the House and Senate for a final vote. And then once passed, it goes to the president. And at that time, the president has 10 days, except not counting Sundays, to sign or veto the bill. And if he or she vetoes the bill, it can still be passed if it then wins a 2/3 vote from Congress. So that's kind of how a bill is passed. I think part of the reason that I got involved and interested in kind of legislative advocacy is there are a lot of venues, through professional venues, through which I've been able to get involved, professional organizations where they essentially corral people with a certain expertise and then kind of teach you about here are your issues that we want you to be aware of, and then they send you to the Capitol. So I've gotten to participate in a couple of these, and Matthew's sort of been in the wing saying, oh, well, that looks pretty cool, what you've been able to do. And so I just have felt really lucky to be able to go and actually talk to our legislators and our representatives in person. And it's definitely one of those things that I would recommend that if you feel passionately about something, definitely go and do it. It's so much easier than I would have ever thought. Any constituent can request a meeting of a representative, and it's even more powerful if you have obviously a specific request or agenda. I think a lot of people just go and say, hey, this is what I'm interested in, or this is about me, but if you kind of go and say, I want you to co-sponsor HR 27, they're willing to take meetings with constituents like that. I just wrote down a couple of tips for success if you do end up getting into a meeting with any of your legislators. So knowing your legislator, what committees they sit on, fireways that they voted, other things that that particular member of your House or Senate has already ruled on, so you kind of know what response you're going to get, really it helps you anticipate, is this going to be an argument, or are they going to be really happy to hear from you as a constituent? Mm-hmm. Knowing talking points and keeping to a message. I mean, some of these are like, probably any meeting you go to, kind of know what you're hoping to get out of it and know what they're going to say back to you, and then be able to make a direct request. So if you are up to date, I mean, the U.S. government has pretty accessible and easy websites for looking up what are they voting on right now, when does the gun bill come up, when does the, you know, in my state, what are we talking about, abortion rights or other things like that. And so knowing when those things are coming up for vote and being able to make a direct request. The other thing that I found when we were there was statistics are always helpful, but personal stories are really what sort of help your members of Congress do a better job and advocate for us, for the people, because they can look up the statistics, and I'm sure that their legislative aides probably have those written down, but what they don't know is, well, because you guys, you know, you made legislation about fire safety or about, you know, abortions, I wasn't able to get this, or our village survived, or personal stories that they can then share with their members of Congress are really the most impactful thing. So, and then I think the other thing is just being able to follow up with people. So this is just sort of like good etiquette, or, you know, getting things done that you wanted to get done in the first place. But being able to follow up and say, hey, so, you know, how did that vote go? Did they end up voting my way? Did they need any more information from me? You know, I'd be happy to stop by at any time. And, so, I don't know. This is kind of something that I feel strongly about, but granted, I think probably all of you are good advocates for things in your own lives, and we can all kind of learn about how to advocate more in our lives as well.
Could you share what you were advocating for your last little trip to D.C.?
Yeah. So every year, the American College of OBGYN picks a couple of different topics, and they tend to pick things. The American College of OBGYN doesn't pick things that are partisan, so sometimes we may advocate for things that are that Republicans would be in support of, and sometimes we would pick things that Democrats would be in support of, but. In the past couple of years, we've lobbied for things like fixing the SGR, the sustainable growth rate, which now is kind of old news, but it was basically this Medicaid, Medicare spending fix, which every year for, I don't know, 25 years, basically said, oh, our costs are going up and up and up, and how are we ever going to get our healthcare costs under control? And every year they would make a patch that says, okay, well, we'll continue to pay for these Medicaid and Medicare patients. But they were basically always threatening to stop the sustainable growth rate. And a lot of physicians were lobbying against that, because when the government says, well, we're going to stop paying for the sustainable growth rate now at this point, then every patient that they maybe got reimbursed 70 cents on the dollar for taking care of Medicaid patients, now they're going to get paid 30 cents on the dollar for taking care of these patients. And so essentially you have a group of providers that are a larger group of providers who are taking care of this population that really needs health care, and you're cutting it back a lot, because a lot of people are going to be saying, well, we can't afford to take care of those patients anymore, because we're actually losing money on every patient we take care of. So that was interesting, because we found that the people that were on the Democratic side of things tended to not support it as much, because they had more investment in the Affordable Care Act, and it was all kind of tied together in the Affordable Care Act, while the Republican side, they were like, oh yeah, we're all on board for that, we just want to get rid of the SGR anyway. Well, now the SGR is gone, so it's kind of old news and really hard to explain anyway, and really kind of stuffy political stuff. But other things that we've lobbied for, especially in the state, or this year, there was a lot of lobbying for recognizing postpartum depression and increasing resources for women in terms of postpartum depression, realizing that we have a lot of postpartum mortality in terms of things that are preventable. One of the main things that we worked really hard to decrease is death from postpartum hemorrhage, and that's when women bleed a lot after a delivery, and sometimes to the point of literally exsanguinating. And we have cut down a lot because of medical advances and decreasing deaths from postpartum hemorrhage, but we still have high, staggering numbers of women who are actually committing suicide due to postpartum depression after after delivery, and it's still, as you know, we're all very well aware, mental health is not probably adequately addressed in a lot of the medical systems that we have, and as well as postpartum depression, there's a huge stigma against getting care. And so some of the lobbying that we did this year was to increase funding for programs related to postpartum depression screening and support programs for new moms. And really, I think it's probably the new frontier of how do we decrease postpartum mortality. And then we also lobbied for a bill on opioid use. So as you probably all are aware, there's a huge problem with opioid use and use, even legal use in the United States. And I hear people talk all the time about being in, oh yeah, I had a friend who was like in England and they had surgery and they were given only NSAIDs, like ibuprofen and medications like that, and not these addictive medications like Percocet, Vicodin, Norco, you know, the opioid medications. And here in the United States, we have just gotten into such a difficult problem of legally prescribing opioid medications that then lead into, you know, it starts with I had surgery or I got into a car accident and I needed the medication for pain and then I became addicted to pain medication and now I can't get it legally anymore, so now I'm on the streets shopping for heroin. You know, and that's just kind of like the worst case scenario. And I think the, along with like the mental illness of postpartum depression, has been realizing that opioid addiction is a mental health kind of a condition that's not just, we can't write it off, you know, we have to deal with it, we need to get people into treatment programs, it's a mental health problem. And so to treat it as such and to get people into treatment programs, and specifically in OBGYN, we care about that because when women are pregnant, they're at not only a vulnerable state where we hope they're coming in for care, and if they're not coming in for care for their mental health or their opioid addiction, then they're certainly probably not coming into care for prenatal care. Mm-hmm. And then also just that a lot of women in that situation are much more willing to rehab themselves. You know, it's a really vulnerable time for people, and they might be much more willing to go enter into an addiction treatment program. And so a lot of the lobbying we did this year was based on those two issues, and they actually both passed, which was really great. And of course, I think we still have a long way to go in terms of both of those, you know, depression. I mean, they're both really this mental health and this opioid problem that we've been having in the United States. I think we definitely could have talked for an hour about abortion and all of the fun things. And I also just wanted to say that, you know, I'm a reference. I'm kind of glad personally to get it over with, but also just then I feel like you guys kind of know me. I'm around this week if you've got questions, and you know, it's OBGYN related or advocacy related, or what was it like, you know, coming here for the first time when you're 32 or whatever.
If you don't want to take the prescription, how can you tell the doctor no? I mean, I'm not kidding. I know people, and it happened to me. I said no, and they gave me that prescription, and I paid for it anyway, twice, for the same thing.
Yeah.
And my one friend, she said, she went in there, and she said, this is the one I said no. And she slammed it down on the counter and said, I'm not paying for this.
Yeah.
The best advice I would have for you on that is, I hear you for sure, and I definitely have patients who will say, I don't need this at all, and sometimes it's easy to say, you know, we've given you a prescription for this before, if you tell me you have some at home, I'm not going to worry about it. Some physicians, I think, are thinking, well, what if it's 3 a.m. and you're having terrible pain, and it's actually pain that could be managed by a medication that is available to you, but it's not a prescription that you can call into a pharmacy. It has to be issued paper. And I'm just trying to explain, well, like,
those are all the arguments that I heard. But what really gets me is that you have it in your house. If somebody breaks into your house, they get it.
Right.
And I don't know what to do with it. And I got a list saying, go to the sheriff and turn it in at the sheriff and the police department. And then I found out it only happens at certain times of the week they will allow you to bring. I mean, it's just insane. Yeah.
So the thing I could tell you is if you could ask for a written prescription, like a script, because they should give it to you as a sheet of paper. They're not allowed to e-prescribe. And so just don't ever fill it.
Yeah.
Or a lot of times pharmacies will take them back in donation, and whatever way that they choose to dispose of them, however they do that, if they're not, I don't know how they handle it exactly, but I hear you, certainly, and of course, you're not the person that we're worried about is getting addicted to opioids right now, because you have a sense of, I'm not in pain, I don't need this pain medication, but it does still contribute, because there you have 30 tabs sitting in your medicine cabinet, and your grandchildren come over, and it's easy access, and you won't even notice by missing pills, and then somebody sells them on the street or whatever.
Yeah,
it's a big problem. So I know we're past our time, and like I said, let me just be a resource for you if you've got questions of the week. I hope that this was a little bit fun and entertaining. It's no Luther in the knees, but anyway, so thank you all for coming, and again, I'm Maureen, I'm here all week, so if you have any questions or want to discuss anything, let me know.